This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution calling for the restoration of Iraq's sovereignty as soon as possible. Exactly when and how that will occur remains unclear, but the resolution underscores international agreement on the idea of sovereignty. At the same time, the very existence of international institutions like the UN has forced a change in what it means to be a sovereign nation. Once it was believed that sovereignty was handed down by God to certain rulers. So what exactly does sovereignty mean in the 21st century? That's today's Talk of the Nation. Join the conversation. Do international organizations and treaties reinforce or erode national sovereignty? And what becomes of a nation's sovereignty when it is invaded and ruled by another country? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Here to talk with us about the role of sovereignty in international law is Hurst Hahnum. He is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and he joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's go way back in history. First of all, how old is the idea of sovereignty?
Oh, it's difficult to tell, but it's certainly several hundred years old, if not more than that. The earliest, smallest communities really didn't have much of a sense of sovereignty. They knew who their governors were. They knew how relationships worked. Sovereignty wasn't necessary to define their relationships with anyone else. But as societies became more complex, as the whole idea of the state came forward, sovereignty became a necessary concept both to identify legitimacy and authority within a state, and also for that authority to have relations with other states and other entities. The concept has changed over the years considerably, and I assume that that's one of the things we'll be talking more about as the conversation continues.
Yeah, let's talk first about what a sovereign nation might have looked like when this idea of sovereignty first became important in international relations. How did it look? How did it behave? How is it different from it is now, let's say?
Well, the idea of sovereignty didn't really begin with the nation or the state. It rather began with something larger. If you go back to the Middle Ages, for instance, sovereignty was thought to reside ultimately with God, and we had something called the Holy Roman Empire, in which, in theory, the political leaders derived their legitimacy, derived their authority from the Pope, indirectly from God. The big shift in this concept occurred in 1648, a date that's very well known to international lawyers, with the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 years' war in Europe. And what this treaty did was to shift from this notion of a hierarchical structure, God on the top, then the Pope and the Emperor, and then various other sources of authorities underneath them, to a much more egalitarian, horizontal kind of structure, where the independent states of Europe became sovereign with respect to one another. They were no longer subservient to the Church or to the Emperor, and they looked nowhere else outside their own borders to express their sovereignty. So sovereignty essentially became equated with independence.
Hmm. And when did, and that lasted for how long? I mean, or does that still last? Is that still how we think of it today? Or has it changed, that idea changed at all?
I think that's basically the way we look at it today. But what has happened is that the degree of freedom or the degree of independence that states get to act within, both within their own borders and with respect to others, has shifted. Sometimes you'll hear the phrase absolute sovereignty, the notion being that if you were the recognized government of a territory, you could do anything you wanted to within that territory. That never really existed because, of course, some of the things you do within your own territory might affect other states. And the notion of sovereignty carries with it the notion of equality, so that Germany is equal to France. It couldn't, for instance, even historically mistreat French citizens, although it could have mistreated its own citizens, and that was no one else's business. As time has gone by over the last couple of centuries, and particularly in the last 50 or 60 years, international law, because sovereignty is an international legal concept, has increasingly tried to place constraints on what a state can do, not only in its international relations, but also within its own borders.
How have international institutions like the United Nations, primarily, I guess, but there are many others, how has the existence, the development of those affected the whole idea of national sovereignty and individual nation sovereignty?
Well, changes in international law are ultimately made by states themselves. The United Nations has no authority to simply pass a resolution of the General Assembly and declare what international law is. But working through international organizations like the UN, states have gradually reached a consensus on how sovereignty should be seen today. For instance, over the last 50 years, human rights has become recognized as a limitation on sovereignty. So it's no longer permissible for any state to commit genocide, to practice widespread racial discrimination, to commit torture, et cetera, et cetera. That's one way in which states have been constrained in their internal practices, and those standards have been articulated largely by the United Nations and also by some regional organizations. In their relationships with one another, the UN also has stepped in, again, as reflecting the will of the member states. For instance, with the prohibition on the use of force. Remember, back in the 19th century, states were still sovereign, but one of the things they could do as sovereigns was to make war on one another. And this was the most common way in which territory was acquired, was simply to start a war and to take over the territory. Since 1945, at least, that's no longer been permissible. And states are prohibited from aggressive wars. They're prohibited from taking territory by force and annexing it, which is what Saddam Hussein tried to do in Kuwait. And these developments have been articulated by the UN. But again, the UN is more of a sounding board than necessarily a leader in establishing these new international norms.
Now, if a nation needs the protection of an international organization, does it, in a sense, give up any of its sovereignty in order to win that or get that protection?
Well, it's very curious in that essentially what's happened is that sovereignty has been both weakened and strengthened over the last several decades. It's been weakened to the extent that states are now more restricted in what they're allowed to do. They're not allowed to make war, they're not allowed to violate human rights, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, once you're recognized as a sovereign state, no other state can make war on you. And we've had no occasion since 1945 where a state has gone out of existence because it's been invaded and annexed by another state. Again, Iraq was the first one to try when it took over Kuwait. And while there have been a lot of wars and many recourses to force over the years, this notion of destroying a state essentially disappeared. So in that sense, sovereignty is much better protected now by international law and by organizations like the UN than it was 100 years ago.
Well, what about the American decision to invade Iraq, to enter into Iraq? What has that done to Iraq's sovereignty?
Well, it's important to clarify that what is happening now is not the restoration of Iraqi sovereignty, but rather just the restoration of the authority in Iraq to the Iraqi people. And this is one of the things that last week's resolution made clear. It reaffirmed the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iraq. It reaffirmed the notion that sovereignty rests with the state of Iraq. And it talked about the temporary nature of the exercise by the transitional authority of obligations and responsibilities under international law. So what has happened is that the coalition, if you want to call it that, is exercising power within Iraq, but nothing's happened to Iraqi sovereignty any more than the sovereignty of Kuwait was interrupted by its occupation by Iraq. The power was interrupted, the authority was interrupted, but the state itself continues.
We're talking about what it means to be a sovereign nation today. The number's 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Peter. He is in Berkeley, California. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thanks for having this topic. I think it's critical. And I just wanted to agree with your speaker that national sovereignty should no longer remain supreme when it comes to gross violation of human rights. And I think that was really a far more justifiable basis for intervention in Iraq than the story about weapons of mass destruction, because it was very clear that Iraqi human rights were being violated on a regular basis. And I wanted to point out that Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution has this wonderfully succinct statement. I'm just flipping to it now as we talk, but it basically says the federal government shall ensure to each state a Republican or representative form of government, and on application of the legislature or the executive, if necessary, for help with domestic insurrection. And that's it. And then it goes on to the next article. And when I read that recently, I said, oh, my God, there it is. There's the insurance of peace for all the 50 states. And by God, we're way behind time to have this at the global level. If a strong global government could guarantee to every member state a Republican or representative form of government and protect each of them against invasion and on application for domestic violence, we'd have world peace.
Well, perhaps we would. I'd like to hear Professor Hanum. Thanks so much for the call, Peter, and
for the opportunity.
For introducing that idea, which I suspect, Professor Hanum, that that's just never going to happen.
Well, I'm not sure it will, and frankly, I'm not sure it would be a good thing if it did happen. I'm a bit skeptical about the powers of a world government, no matter how it is set up, to deal with all of the problems in the world. It's also problematic when one talks about invading a country to protect human rights. That's a new concept. It's one thing to say that a state is obliged to respect human rights. It's quite another thing to say that an outside state can go in, kill the citizens of state one in order to save its people. I would agree that it would be a good idea if states were more willing to do this in the very extreme cases, Rwanda, for instance, during the genocide in 1994. The problem with the U.S. actions in Iraq is that human rights violations, while they were severe in the sense of being very repressive, in fact, weren't that much worse at the time of the invasion than they were in many other parts of the world. There was no genocide going on, even though it had occurred earlier. And the problem is that it's a bit difficult to define exactly what level of human rights violations should justify invasion from the outside. And I think that, unfortunately, the lesson that Iraq has given to many countries is that that barrier is a bit looser. And while I spoke earlier about sovereignty being reinforced and the state being better protected, if we expand this notion of either preemptive war or humanitarian war, we may well be opening the gates to something that won't look very pretty a few years from now.
And the whole question of human rights, as important as it is, you do see accusations hurled back and forth between countries about the question of human rights violations.
Well, I think that's right, and that's one of the reasons that it's dangerous to just talk about human rights violations in a general sense as justifying the use of force. I think if one wanted to say that outsiders should be able to use force to prevent the widespread loss of life, for instance, that seems to me to be a somewhat more objective standard, one that we can measure. For instance, in the early 1990s, when the United States went into Somalia to try to prevent the starvation of some half million people, that would seem to me to be a justifiable intrusion into sovereignty. On the other hand, if you look at Iraq, if you even look at Kosovo, those are much more difficult to justify. And as I say, we're really opening Pandora's box. If we go too far in the direction of saying that unilaterally, particularly, a state has the right to decide whenever it should invade another state, the UN Security Council is far from a perfect beast. It's very difficult to get it to work. But it is one check on the notion of a single state or a bunch of states within a region attempting to go it on their own.
We're talking about what it means to be a sovereign nation and how it fits into notions of international law. When we come back, we'll look at sovereignty in Islam as both Afghanistan and Iraq try to craft a new constitution. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about sovereignty and its relation to international law as the UN calls for a sovereign Iraq. Our guest is Herse Hanem, professor of international law at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Do you have questions about the idea of sovereignty and how it's evolved? Join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's take a call now from Phil. He's in California. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that the issue of sovereignty lately, the way I've been thinking about it, is there's the issue of sovereignty of the people, which, like the Constitution, I think is inalienable. But then there's the issue of the sovereignty of the government in charge of those people, which can be abrogated by acts of that government. So, for example, in Rwanda, although the government abrogated its rights against maybe foreign intervention because of the atrocities, there's no way a country can go in and invade and take over that the people have sovereignty. And I think that's the problem often in U.S. foreign affairs, is the two are kind of mixed up. So we'll see what happens with Iraq. Supposedly, the U.S. went to Iraq to protect the sovereignty of the people by destroying the sovereign government.
Professor Hanem?
I think that Phil has identified one of the important shifts that has occurred over the last few decades, in that, let's say 50 years ago, a country was sovereign, and it didn't really matter exactly what its internal government structure was. It could be a monarchy, it could be a dictatorship, it could be a democracy. Again, because of the influence of human rights, some democratic expression of the will of the people is considered to be much more important. However, we haven't gotten to the stage yet where the international community is willing to say to a state, we're going to de-recognize you as a state. We're going to refuse to recognize your sovereignty simply because you're a dictatorship or simply because you're not sufficiently democratic. Perhaps that day will come, but as I expressed earlier, I'm a bit skeptical that we're going to be able to make those judgments in a very ready fashion. The speaker was certainly right, though, in reminding us that sovereignty is something that rests inside the country, and so it's not something that is available to be expropriated by whoever the intervener happens to be. And certainly within human rights norms, the hope is that governments will become more representative, that we can begin to talk about the will of the people or the sovereignty of the people in a way that's more meaningful than has been the case over the last several centuries.
All right, thanks for your call, Phil. Some say the notion of sovereignty plays a slightly different role in Islam. Sovereignty comes not from international law, but from God's relationship to the individual. John L. Esposito is a professor of religion and international affairs at Georgetown University. He's also the author of Unholy War, Terror in the Name of Islam. He says this difference will influence how new laws are shaped as Afghanistan and Iraq try to craft a new constitution. He joins us now from Marco Island in Florida. Thanks for being with us, Professor Esposito. In many ways, Professor Esposito, the Islamic notion of sovereignty seems more like the original notion or the original idea that we were talking about earlier in the show, which is that sovereignty comes from God in some way. Is that right?
Yes. And as we know, in a number of religious traditions, there was the sense of sovereignty comes from God because God is the creator and ruler and judge of the universe. And so historically, for example, in Christendom, you had people, rulers who said that they ruled by, as it were, divine right. And in Islam, you have the notion of the sovereignty of God, yes.
And if God is sovereign, if all sovereignty comes from God, what is the relationship between God and state then in Islam?
Well, I think that, you know, there's also another notion that comes in here, and the Quran talks about it, that human beings are God's representatives, the vicegerent, that is, that human beings are charged with carrying out or implementing God's will on earth. And so that gets expressed in a number of ways historically. For example, early on in Islam, you developed the notion of the caliphate. The caliph or khalifa is the successor of the prophet, not as prophet, but as ruler of the community. And one way to legitimate the caliph was, of course, to say that the caliph's job was to assure God's rule, to defend Islam. And so down through history, you've had, if you will, this kind of Muslim rule. And more contemporary times, you have a variety of so-called or self-styled Islamic governments, from Saudi Arabia to Iran to the Taliban. But you also have today the notion becoming more and more debated and prevalent that well, wait a minute, you know, if human beings are to carry out God's will, and if they're God's representatives on earth, then how about representational government, parliamentary forms of government, and therefore that in a way that you transfer the power from an individual to the people.
Now, when it comes to creating a constitution, such as is occurring in Afghanistan and Iraq, how do these Islamic beliefs, how will it affect that process?
It can go in a number of ways. It's a very good question. You know, you're more often your more traditional folk will wind up saying something like, well, if we're going to talk about creating, let's say, in Afghanistan, if we're going to create a state and the vast majority of people are Muslims, it should somehow be Muslim or Islamic. And this means implementing God's law, the Sharia, God's law, as it was developed and interpreted in the past, and simply, in other words, restoring it or implementing it. On the other hand, you're more reform-minded, and we see this debate in Afghanistan today, will say that what you had historically were Muslims applying the principles and values of sacred scriptures, for example, of the Quran, to the realities of life at that time. Now the historic and social circumstances have changed. And specifically with regard to Islamic law, the debate gets nuanced even more, where people will say, therefore, we can have a Muslim country that is a democracy, and our laws do not only simply have to be drawn from Islam, but we can have any laws that do not contradict Islamic principles and values. And this allows for a sort of broad borrowing from other legal systems, as well as developing new laws that are appropriate. So what you're saying is it's not even that they have to be directly derived, all of the laws, but that they can simply be laws that do not in any way go against the basic principles and values of the religion.
And what about in Iraq, where you have both Sunni and Shiite Muslims? Are there different interpretations?
There are. And I mean, I think that the situation in Iraq will itself be complicated, because you have Sunni and Shia, but you also have, and I think it's important to keep in mind, you have many people who, we have Sunni, Shia, you also have Kurds, but you have many people who are very secular-minded and believe that religion should be a separate from society or public life, that it should be a personal matter. And so you have a variety of interests here as one tries to develop a representative form of government in Iraq. It's going to have to deal with the reality of religious and political pluralism. And I think that that's going to be a real challenge.
Professor Hanum, going back to our earlier discussion of the larger questions of sovereignty in international law and as the international community views it, is there anything different about the way the international community then views Islamic nations in the question of sovereignty?
No, there really doesn't need to be, and I think Professor Esposito's comments underscore the difference from sovereignty looking outwards and sovereignty looking inwards. The sovereignty looking inwards gives to states the ability to devise their governmental system however they wish, subject to international human rights norms. And so an Islamic country or a Christian country or a Jewish country can develop their own internal laws according to their own beliefs. Externally, however, it's a bit difficult to figure out exactly what God has to say at any particular time. The caliphate is gone. There are many different countries that have Muslim majorities and that, to some extent or another, base their laws on Islam. And so we really need to continue to look to the governments of those countries, whether those governments take their inspiration from secular sources or religious sources, rather than worrying too much about the ultimate sovereignty of God versus the people versus the government.
We're talking about sovereignty, what it means to be a sovereign nation, the number 800-989-8255. I have an email here. It says, how does sovereignty come into play in our war on terrorism? In a traditional war, there is a sovereign state or states that can be victorious or defeated. How do we know when we win the war on terrorism? Professor Hanum first. I'd like you to respond to that.
Well, I think that one of the problems with the so-called war on terrorism is that we will never know when we win it. I think it's a mistake to call it a war, and the appropriate analogy is not World War II or World War I, but crime syndicates and drug syndicates and others, and the anarchists perhaps of the early 20th century. States can use force in self-defense against other states. And I think most of the world thought that the U.S. actions in Afghanistan, for instance, were justified as acts of self-defense. But if this is a war, it's a very different one. And I think it's one that we're unlikely to win so long as we think of it as in traditional warlike senses.
Professor Esposito, do Islamic nations see themselves as targeted or their sovereignty as threatened by the war on terrorism?
I think they do. Let me just say that I agree with what my colleague just said, and I think it's really important the way he framed it. And I found, for example, early on after we declared the so-called war against global terrorism, in dealing in some context in Britain, a number of British officials simply avoided the word war because it communicates a more classic type situation, and I just don't think it fits. But to answer your specific question, my experience has been that, indeed, the day after 9/11, as I mentioned in many of my public talks, I received an email from someone in the region who said, it's terrible what happened, and one needs to take, you know, go after Osama and bring Osama and al-Qaeda to justice. But we in the region wonder and worry about whether this is the beginning or the end. And I replied and said, what do you mean? She replied and said, will this become a pretext for redrawing the map of the Middle East? And I think that this is a real issue. There are many across the Muslim world and across the spectrum, socioeconomically, educationally, politically, who tend to see the unfolding of this war as targeting Islam in the Muslim world, and more see it not so much as a war against global terrorism, but, if you will, a war against Islam and the Muslim world. And I think that it's going to be a challenge to any administration, how to wage that war, but also how to wage it and how to monitor one's statements in a way that doesn't play into that perception.
All right. Let's take a call now from Billy, and he's in Kosovo. Billy.
Yes. I just want to know your guest opinion about the war in Kosovo, which was back in 99, where NATO went to war with a sovereign nation, and it basically, in essence, created another sovereign state within another that isn't officially recognized. It's a pretty perplexing situation. I've been here for about 2 years, and there have been some improvements and some basic infrastructure stuff, but the situation is pretty terrible here. And it's a pretty much forgotten about place, the Balkans in general, but this place is still very unstable, and nobody seems to really care about it too much anymore. So I'm going to hang up and listen to what your guests have to say, and thank you very much.
Thanks so much for your call, Billy. Professor Hanum?
Well, I think the caller raises a very important issue, and in many ways, Kosovo was the predecessor to Iraq, although we failed to recognize that. I think the war in Kosovo was illegal because I don't think that the degree of human rights violations met the very high level that I articulated earlier. But it's interesting that the sort of quasi-protectorate that we have established there still respects the sovereignty of Yugoslavia, and it shows in some ways how attached we still are to the notion of the sanctity of borders. My guess is that at some stage there will have to be a negotiated solution between Belgrade and the Albanians in Kosovo that may well result in an independent Kosovo. But for right now, the attachment is still to the state of Serbia and Montenegro, which is at best ironic given the fact that the rest of the former Yugoslavia has disintegrated.
Hrst Hanum is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Hanum, what do you mean when you said that Kosovo is a predecessor to Iraq? I'd like you to explain that a little bit more.
Well, I think that the reasons for intervention that were articulated by President Clinton in some ways reflect the kinds of issues that your first caller addressed. The notion was that there were terrible human rights violations in Kosovo. Therefore, even without the authorization of the Security Council, which was never requested by the United States, it was all right for outside countries to go ahead and invade based on their own perception that this was necessary. Now, there was a bit more justification. At least NATO, which is a regional organization, went along with the United States, and that gave it some political cover. But as a legal matter, I think that it's very clear that the only time that that sort of force is authorized under current international law is when it's given approval by the Security Council in advance. It's a closer case than Iraq, where the reasons for the invasion were not primarily humanitarian, where there was no regional organization that supported the invasion and the so-called coalition of the willing, apart from Britain, seemed to be a lot of countries that needed trade and aid from the United States and not much else. But I think that precedent of invading based on the opinions and the desires of the invader, as opposed to some more objective criteria, set the stage for what happened in Iraq.
Yes, go ahead.
Just by coincidence, I returned recently from a period of time in the Balkans, speaking to the various communities involved. And the end of my trip actually was in Belgrade. One of the things that I noted along the way, whether in Bosnia, Croatia, or in Belgrade, for many Serbs, the sense is still that Kosovo, even though they are now population-wise a minority, that Kosovo is their primary religious center. And often they continue to refer to it as their Jerusalem and make comparisons, therefore, to themselves as basically put themselves and say, you know, we are like the Jews and Israel in terms of our, you know, cling to Jerusalem and in terms of the conflict. So it's still, Kosovo is still remains a very important, you know, both symbolically but in a very real way, religiously and territorially.
Let me ask you both, just as we end the show here, what is the obligation of the international community? What does the international community have to do to help a country to establish its sovereignty again and to consolidate its sovereignty again, as in the case of Iraq, after another country has invaded it for whatever the reason might be?
Well, I think there are two questions. One is what the obligations of the international community are, and at least in terms of the occupying power, that's relatively clear. The United States and the British are obliged to return institutions to the Iraqi people, not to exploit the country, et cetera, et cetera. But the other question is a bit more difficult, and that is just how much can outsiders do? The Balkans are a very good example. Tens of thousands of troops are still there nearly 10 years after the Dayton Accords. We're attempting to put countries back together in West Africa and in many other parts of the world. And I don't want to sound overly pessimistic, but I think it's important that we have a realistic understanding of just how much can be accomplished from the outside. There are things that can be done. There is assistance that can be given. But ultimately, the decision has to be, if we believe in democracy, the wishes of the people themselves.
Well, thanks to both of you for being with me today. Hurst Hunnam is professor of international law at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. John Esposito is a university professor of religion and international affairs at Georgetown University. When we come back, we'll talk to the political editor of the Des Moines Register about why some Democrats are passing on the Iowa caucuses. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.